continue our study of covenants. We've gotten to the covenant with Noah. Again, some of the elements of the covenant structure that we've been talking about are shadowy. They get a little clearer as we go along as far as the elements of the bond, of course, that God makes, the life and death situation of each covenant. And, of course, God, we know, sovereignly brings these things about. And that's one of the things I want to point out tonight, especially when it comes to Noah, because of the different things that you might be taught, not from me, but if you did happen to go to seminary or Bible college, you get some teachers that will teach some things that I think are they muddy the water of God's grace in the way that they teach things about, like choosing Abraham. We talk about a lot, and we'll get into that. This one is the covenant of preservation, is what might be called the Noahic covenant of preservation. We've seen where God, it appears God had a covenant with creation initially, then he had the covenant with Adam, where you have the life and the death and the bond that he makes with them there, and of course the promise of a seed that would come. Well, as the story moves along, you've got the godly seed of Seth, and you've got the ungodly seed of Cain. You have both of those families listed. You have the one in end of chapter 4, the family of Cain. Then you have the family of Adam in chapter 5. And this is the godly line. Noah comes from this line, this godly line of men that begins with Adam and, of course, then with Seth. And then that moves through all the way to Noah and his sons, Methuselah, you know, Lamech, and these guys. And Noah lives, you know, he's 500 years old before he even begins to have these sons, according to the last verse there of chapter 5. So I want to begin with chapter 6. I want to just read this, beginning right at the verse 1. I don't intend to read the entire story, but I do want to read this part because I think this is important. Genesis 6, verse 1. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. Now I believe that is a reference to the time frame left before the flood, not that he's going to suddenly, people are going to live to be 120 years old, but it's going to be 120 years before the flood, so Noah's going to be building the ark during that time. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. I want to stop there for a minute. This verse is usually misunderstood, I think highly misunderstood and mistaught, that these were fallen angels who came to earth and coupled with these women, and they had these giant, you know, children, these giant humanoid children, physically giants and all this. And this is typically comes from the dispensational camp. And I completely disagree with this. And I tell you why, because it's not contextual. There's nothing contextual about angels coming down. It doesn't say that. What just happened in chapter 5? What did I point out to you that just happened in chapter 5? What did they give us there? Gave us the genealogy of God's men. These were the godly line, right? So the sons of God then contextually would be that line, and then the daughters of men would be the women who came from Cain's line. Okay? Now this is all in here. This is not like we're drawing this out of the, you know, the thin air and making some supernatural story take place. This is right all right here in the text. Also, notice what it says about the giants in verse 4. They were mighty men, men of renown. Okay? So they weren't giant in stature. They were just well known. Men of renown. Made a name for themselves. All right? So that's where I come to from this text. That this text is not, we're not leaving and finding some interesting story that it's very interesting. And I grew up on that story, by the way. I grew up believing that. I was taught that all of my life. And then somebody pointed out and said, well, what about all these guys in chapter 5? Who are they? Those are the sons of God. They intermarry. God's not okay with this now. This is actually not a good thing that they're doing. They intermarry and bad things happen. Jack. Well, I didn't this time. I have looked at it before. Okay. The last of the verse, though, interprets for me what's going on in chapter 4. Yeah. I mean, verse 4. I don't know. You'd have to look it up and see. It probably means stature. It likely means that. But then it's explained at the end. It's kind of like us using giants, but we don't mean physical. And then we say, these are great men. You know, they're giants. And nobody thinks we're talking, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's, that contextually, they're saying that these were men who'd made a name for themselves. Well-known men who were, they might be called giants. The problem with the other explanation is they begin with that word giants, it appears, and then back up from that. As if they were giant stature, where'd they come from? Well, they must have come from fallen angels, blah, blah, blah. You know, and they come up with this. And I understand that angels could be called sons of God in another place. I understand that. But I just don't see it here. So anyway, that's really not the issue. I just wanted to bring that out because we're reading it, and this is a misunderstood text. So I think that this is all human beings. This is going on here. This is not supernatural characters involved. Lord saw that verse 5. Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Notice that verse. See, that verse helps me think we're talking about men here too and not fallen angels. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And he said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. However, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Okay. Let's stop here for a minute and talk about this grace that Noah found in the eyes of the Lord. The plight of man is in verse 5, 6, and 7. They are evil, wicked men who appear cannot be reformed, at least in the sense that God is done with them at this point. He's done with them. Not that he couldn't fix them, he certainly could. But he's done with them. He's going to make a point, a very serious point. And he's never going to repeat this again in this way. We'll look at what he does, though. He does the death part with the covenant with Noah. We'll see that part, too, the blood part. But this is God's judgment on wicked man. And yet, Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, without having to go to every piece of scripture, because I understand our time is slipping away from us. But in Hebrews 11, Noah is mentioned as acting on faith. He built the ark. He acted on faith. He responded to God in faith. All right, so it also says he became an heir of righteousness, which is according to faith, there in chapter 11, verse 7. But there are those who teach that Noah was righteous prior to God calling him. That Noah showed faith and did not act like some of the other sons of God, some of the other godly line, and that Noah was a guy that God could trust, and so he chose Noah. That is an Arminian view. It is not biblical in my opinion, because faith is a gift that is given. It has to be given to someone before they can act on it. Men are not born with faith. We don't have any evidence that men are born with faith. That's an inference that's made based on the command that God gives for men to respond in faith and to come to him in faith. The inference is made, well, then man must have it. But it's not a biblical idea. No one's told that all men have faith. We're actually told that faith is a gift that God gives. And when he gives that faith, men respond. All right, so Noah was not a decent guy until God gave him faith to believe. God showed grace and gave him faith. If you have faith, it's because God showed you grace. He shows you grace and he gives you faith. And guess what you do with it? You don't trash it. You don't decide to throw it out and go, I didn't really want that, God. Thank you anyway. I want to go on my own way. That's not how we respond. We irresistibly now respond to Him in the faith that He gave us. And so did Noah. It's interesting how we can talk about this in a New Testament way and everybody goes, yeah. But then we get in the Old Testament, people go, I don't know about that. It's exactly the same. It's not a different story. It's not a different God. He responds the same way. We have more information than Noah had. But when he was given that faith, it was a grace work of God in his life, and he responded. And that's why he built the ark. He didn't build the ark because he was a decent guy and a good construction worker. He built the ark because God gave him faith to believe. He goes on, he's going to tell him that the rain's going to come. My understanding, and I guess there's a difference of opinion about this too, my understanding is that it had not rained yet. The seasons, there were not seasons yet. There were no clouds in the sky. There was a mist. So he knew what water was. You know, he drank water and there was water, but there was no rain. And he says it's going to rain. So that's a lot of faith. To believe that something that he's never seen and did not know existed and not even sure what it is, I guess, is going to come. He says the rain's coming from the heavens and it's going to rise up from the deep. And Noah is just going to believe that because he's a decent guy? No, he's going to believe that because Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And now Noah is able to follow because Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That's why he followed. That's why he builds the ark. That's why he is an heir of righteousness in Hebrews 11. So, there's a lot of grace here. And this grace is going to extend to his wife, his three sons, and their wives. They're not mentioned as receiving grace from God in the text. Now, I think they did, but they're not mentioned as finding grace in the eyes of the Lord, just Noah. They're recipients of the grace, in a sense. But then we find out about Ham later, don't we? Ham was on the ark, but Ham's heart is with Cain's line. So, God even puts a bad guy on the ark. And yet we can still say that's gracious. But why didn't he just put all good people on there? Because he's actually keeping both lines going. The godly line and the ungodly line. But while Ham was on the ark, he obeyed. He was under authority. He worked. There's no reason to believe there was any trouble out of Ham whatsoever. Ham shows his heart afterwards. And then he's banished. The ungodly line continues and the godly line continues. And then God has that history of redemption that continues on. All right, so there's grace involved in this. God sovereignly brings that grace about. And then he makes a covenant with Noah and he says this. Verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was just man. Perfect in his generations, Noah walked with God. Again, he walked with God because he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God. Earth was filled with violence. God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said, the end of all flesh has come before me. He said this to Noah, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark. And he goes on to describe all of that. Look at verse 18. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives, and with you. You're going to bring animals with you, birds and animals of their kind, and you'll take food for yourself and all of this. Verse 22, thus Noah did. According to all that God commanded him, so he did. And then the Lord told him to get into the ark there in chapter 7. And and all of that takes place there. And then the waters came, and you've got the deliverance of Noah and his family there in chapter 7 and chapter 8. And then at the end of chapter 8, you've got God making the covenant in the sense with the creation, saying that he's never going to curse the ground again. Noah built an ark there in verse 20, an altar. And he took the clean animal and every clean bird, offered burnt offerings. The Lord smelled a soothing aroma, and he said this in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. Notice that. Notice why it's important what he just said. He destroys the earth because there's nothing but violence and men's hearts are wicked. So he destroys the earth. He destroys all the men. I guess he did, in a sense, destroyed all the trees and these things, and they were gone. Oldest tree in the world right now. You know how old the oldest tree in the world is, approximately, that they know of? 4,500 years old. Yeah. 4,500 years old, which means the flood was 4,500 years ago. And that's just not hard to do, that math. The oldest tree's 4,500 years. Well, that tree, you know. So, young earth. I'm young earth. Yeah. Not everybody is. I am. But he says, I will, even though the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. So, man's heart didn't change. Even though Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, Ham is going to be on the ark. Noah doesn't know this yet and doesn't know what's going to happen, but God does. So how can he make this declaration of man's heart if all of them had grace? Because God changed Noah's heart. But he makes this declaration of men who are going to not exist yet or who don't exist yet. Because he says, I'm not going to destroy the earth again, even though man's heart will never change. So I'm not going to do it that way ever again. While the earth remains seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, the day and night shall not cease. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, all that move on the earth, fish of the sea, they are given to your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Notice that. There is no dietary law at this point. They can eat anything they want. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. Everything was theirs to have. It's interesting that I find this interesting because he did understand clean and unclean. And yet God says you can eat anything you want. It's later that he separates and says, don't be eating this, don't be eating that. But for now, you can eat anything you want. All the things, these things that came off the ark, as they give birth to other little ones, that's food for you. Help yourself. Whatever it is. I find that interesting. Of course, he says in verse 4, but don't eat the blood. That's the life. And then he says this. This is interesting. This is where the bond with Noah is the blessing of the family, and the covenant with Noah is, and he'll go on and talk about actually making the covenant and all of that. But this is the covenant that he's making with Noah for the blessing, the food. This is all yours, and I'm not going to destroy the earth again. He says, but this, surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I'll require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Verse 6, though, is important. The blood of the covenant now, the blood part of the covenant is, you do not get to murder someone. If you see, that was not, the capital punishment is just now. They didn't have capital punishment prior to this. Or there's no indication from Scripture they had capital punishment. Right? This is it. This is it right here. This is where we get it, at least initially in Scripture. That doesn't mean it was okay to kill. We just don't have it so clearly delineated now. And so this seems to be a part of the covenant. That now, to premeditated murder is man's attempt to be God. Right? Isn't that what that is? It's man's attempt to be God. I am going to kill you because of whatever. Here's my list of reasons to kill you. And I'm going to do that. I'm just going to be okay for me to do that. All right, so when you become God, what are you at that point? There's a lot of things, but what are you when you think you are God? Judge, okay. Covenantally speaking, though, what are you? Yeah, you're about to say it. You are a covenant breaker, right? And what happens when you're a covenant breaker?
You pay the price.
You give your life. That's right. And that's where you get the bond in blood. See, the bond is the, I will never destroy the earth again. However, if you try to become me, I take your life. That's basically what's being said here. Andy.
Of the 40 of them.
Yes. Right. We have been given the mandate to take a life done biblically with all of the things in place. And not on our own, but collectively as a community. But usually premeditated murder is one guy's act and deciding he's judge, jury, and everything else. And to do that, you're playing God and you're a covenant breaker, and now it's your life. So you die for breaking the covenant. So that's kind of the idea here. All right, let's continue. Another question, comment before we continue on, Josh?
Question back in verse 18. Is this the same covenant being referred to here, or is it a different covenant? Verse 18 says, "Behold with thee, will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy son, and my wife, and my son, and his wife."
Where are we? You said. I think so. No, I think that it's the same one. He said, "I will establish my covenant with you, and I believe this is it." Yeah, I believe that this is the covenant that he's referring to. Because he says, the language there is, it's a future. I will do this. But for now, get in the ark. I'm going to destroy everything. I'm going to preserve you. Yes, Benjamin.
Whenever you're done with that, I'd like to, if you don't mind, step back to the 120 years.
Sure. I think so, yeah.
Okay, and I'm looking at, it says that Noah was 500 years old at the time of the genealogy that was given, and he was 600 when he went into the ark. I was just looking for some clarification.
Oh, okay. I could have my numbers could be off there. But I was thinking that he, somewhere, it was referenced that he was a, when he preached, and not just in 2 Peter because it doesn't say it, but that there was 120 years that he preached while he was building the ark.
It, well, that doesn't say specifically 100 years. It says that he preached.
I know that in 2 Peter. I was thinking there was another place, though, that mentions that. Is that not true? Is that just something I was told? Well, now, in 2 Peter, where it says he was a preacher of righteousness, does not have a time period.
Right. Hebrews does not either.
Okay. Moses.
4 or 5 years ago, I was on creation.com, and they said that's what you said it meant. That whenever God said that was 120 years before the flood. So you're not the only one to come up with that.
Okay.
In Psalms, where it says 70 years.
25 years in strength, 80.
Yeah. And the person said that is for people that are outside the grace of God. He says a righteous person can live longer than that. And he's supposedly getting that from the context of that. So.
Wicked men live longer than 70 years.
Yeah, no doubt. And we've seen righteous people die young. Just throw this out as an observation. From chapter 5 to chapter 6, I don't know is necessarily chronologically exactly what's going. Exactly what's going on there, and in other words, did he tell him this before he, was he 500 years old when he gave birth to all three of his boys? Or is he just saying Noah was 500 years old and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and you see what I'm saying? He didn't give birth to all three of those boys when he was 500. So you got that. And so it could be that when he actually... Yeah, I could have. Did you just make that up or did somebody say that?
I'm just saying it's
Well, you're right. You're right. It is feasible. I didn't think about that. Well, I mean, it does mention twins, you know, with Jacob and Esau, but that's because it's an important twin thing to be talked about, because Romans 9 is going to be coming later. And
I think the triplets were Tice here, and that was a bad reason, too.
Well, later on, though, we find out Shem is older, though he's the older brother. But that doesn't mean he wasn't born first out of triplets. Okay, listen, we're getting far afield here from our covenant. Listen, I'm not dying on this hill of what that 120 years means exactly, so.
Okay.
Okay, where were we?
9:6.
Okay. Reading on. Verse 8, God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "As for me, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." And he goes on, verse 11, "This I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And this is the sign. What's the sign? Before you read on, what's the sign of the covenant? This one. Kids, what's the sign for this one?
Rainbow.
A rainbow. Very good. He said in verse 13, "I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Shall be when I bring cloud over the earth." And he goes on, he talks about that. And then verse 17, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." So he establishes it with Noah and his sons, but it's really established with all of us as well. And so this is the Noahic covenant that has the elements of the sovereignty of God in bringing all of these things about, the bond that he makes to say that I shall never do this again. And then the covenant, if you're the covenant breaker, is the one that decides to take life, because God alone can take life and give life except when he says otherwise. Like when he says don't kill, but then he tells his people to go in and wipe out all the Canaanites. His law trumps everything. His word trumps anything at all. So it's premeditated and all of that, but it's not murder because God said to do it. All right, and this is hard. A lot of times I talk with people that just they don't get this, and they want the God of the Old Testament to be different. They want him to be this different God. God operated differently. He was different, whatever. You know, you had that historically as well. It's still going on today. And it's not that way at all. It's a misunderstanding of God. God does not have to answer to us. He can change things that he wants to. What he doesn't do is violate his character. He never violates his own character. He never violates his own word. And so if he gives me a word that I don't understand, then the problem is I don't understand. The problem is not the word. The problem is with me. Because God's not going to give me a word that contradicts something he said before. So if I am questioning God, the problem is with me. I am thinking I am smarter than God. Very dangerous place to be. Men who think that find themselves in a judgmental situation and find themselves being judged. All right, why did God preserve Noah? Why? Why did he do that? Why even preserve a man? Of course, for his glory. What are the other reasons? What is one major reason? That's exactly right. Redemption is still Genesis 3. Redemption, right?
Yeah, God had not he was not consigning the earth to the devil. He hadn't given up his original plan.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he makes this declaration in Genesis 3, verse 15, of the crushing of the head. Her seed shall crush his head. Okay, well, he could have started over. He could have wiped everything out, and he could have started brand new with righteous people. It would have avoided everything that had gone before. He had, like you said, he'd already established all this, I think, from the foundation of the world. I don't think he was caught off by surprise when Eve reached for the fruit or whatever that was that she reached for and took a bite of. I don't think he was caught off guard by that at all, and that all of this was in his plan from the beginning, the flood, the everything. So even when it says God was sorry that he'd done this, you've got to be careful how you interpret that. Did God look at that and go, man, I should have done that better? Why did I do that? I should do this different. If that were the case, then you would have thought he would have just gone, poof, gone, start over. So it doesn't mean that, does it? But we understand that language. We understand it. That what's that word they use for that? Ascribing emotions. Anthropomorphic is the word. It's when you ascribe human qualities, emotions, and the fact when they say God has hands, you know, God's arm is not too short that it can't save, right? Then we find out God's a spirit and doesn't have arms. But they say arms, right? Because we understand that. We understand, especially if we study this and we get more in line with the way God thinks, we can understand what he means when he says God was sorry. Not in the sense of, I could have done that better, why didn't I do this different? I think God could have... I'm careful to say things like this, but I do think God is emotional. And it could be that it broke his heart, but not the way we experience it. Not our brokenness usually comes from something that's tinged with selfishness and, you know, pride and arrogance and why didn't I get my way kind of stuff. God does not feel that way. At the same time, I think God can look upon it as Jesus looked over Jerusalem and wept. And yet it was not a surprise to him at all. It's not as if he said, man, I thought you were going to be different. No. He knew who they were, knew what they were going to be, and he weeps over them. Weeps over Jerusalem, the city, weeps over the leaders that hated him so bad. But he didn't weep over them with some sort of, I wish I could have done more. And I don't even know I fully understand all of that. You may have a better understanding of what he was going on with Christ when he wept over that. I don't, you know, it's deep. It's deep stuff. But the point is, God was not sorry in the sense of making a mistake. He doesn't make mistakes. We, again, if we think he made a mistake, we need to back up and look at it again because we're probably misinterpreting it in some way. So I find it so much easier to approach the text with the idea that God is sovereign in all things. He doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't mess up. He doesn't contradict his word. And I come away from the text much more understanding if I come to it, understanding that there's a God who does not mess things up. So when he makes a covenant, he's making that covenant not for himself, right? God doesn't have to make this covenant so he won't break it, right? So he can look back and go, oh, that's right, I made a covenant. He doesn't have to do that, right? He's God. He doesn't break covenant. He does this for us. And then what does he do beyond that for us? He fulfills the covenant bargain. And he reminds us that we are covenant breakers without him. That is grace, just as he showed it to Noah. Noah would have been a covenant breaker if it had not been for grace. He was a covenant breaker. He was shown grace, and so are we. God doesn't break covenant. He does not to be reminded, even when he says he remembered Noah and his family on the ark, right? As if he forgot. They're the only ones left. It's not like he forgot about them. But he remembered them in the sense of the promise, the grace, the preservation. Just as I think he remembers us. He made promises to us. Didn't have to. He chose to do that. We read those promises and then we experience those promises because he's remembering us. He doesn't forget us. Benjamin. And he continues to test him. He tests him when he comes off the yard. Yep.
I think another thing, too, is we're trying to impress. And I think that's why this scriptures are inspired, is he's trying to present to us an eternal truth in the context of the limitations of our minds and of the environment, including the fact that we're time constrained. And so it's fascinating that he does it so well, and then we get out of it what we did get.
Isn't he gracious that he doesn't speak a language we can't understand, but always take his messages and put them in a context that makes sense to you? Like the parables. It's harder for us to relate to some of this stuff now. The audience there, they would have gotten it. It makes sense.
Yeah. I was going to add that God is merciful because he knows our frame, so he writes his book so we can understand it. That's the whole point. People that to explain theology want people to understand it. One thing I was just thinking, this reminded me of Psalm 9. He shall, when he maketh inquisition for blood, he remembereth them. He forgetteth not to cry out the humble. One of the amazing things about God is that he chooses to remember certain things and will purposely forget other things. Yet he forgets our transgression. He purposes to remember when he makes inquisition for blood. This is a great character quality for us to emulate because, we're finite. Okay, we have long-term memory, but we have to choose what we put in that memory. I mean, unless for something traumatic. So, one thing about, discipline is learning to remember certain things. Okay, this was important. And it all comes under just framing the mind, building the mind. So, there's a lot more I guess I can say about that. I spent about 3 days just kind of soaking that in.
Now, I want to make an important point. I've made this before. I want to make it again. Most of the time when the story of Noah is given, who do they tell you about?
Noah.
They tell you about Noah. Right? Especially when you're a kid. They want to tell you about how good Noah was, what a great guy Noah was. And you come away knowing some things about Noah that may or may not be biblical. But what we just came away from this story was about God, which is what we're supposed to come away from every story in the Scripture. That's why I'm opposed to teaching my children the stories of Noah and leave it at that. We never did that. You want to learn about Abraham? That's fine. But we're going to learn about Abraham's God. Abraham is a player in God's story. He's important, but God is the reason we're learning about Abraham. God is the reason we're learning about Noah. God is the reason we're learning about Adam, David, you name it. The purpose of these stories is for us to talk about how great God is. That's the purpose. This is why the church is in the mess she's in, is because people want to talk about Noah and Abraham and not God. Because Noah's not going to hold you accountable for anything. Noah's dead. Noah is this great character, and people go, you should preach righteousness because Noah did. Noah was a righteous man. Noah was a man that God walked with God. You should do all of these things because Noah did it. Why? Because Noah did it? I don't know Noah. I don't know anything about Noah. You see, anyway, I just had to put that plug in because this has been one of my pet peeves for so long that material is written about this kind of stuff and you come away knowing nothing about God.
Can I add one more thing there?
Absolutely.
This is another major problem with the way we teach history. Well, we may teach God in the Bible, and then when you get to Napoleon and Hitler, go
on. I know. And it's his story, right? His story. It's not ours. We are players. We are invited guests into his storyline. We are not the main players. And yet you would think the way that things are done, man is the center of all things. He's the measure of all things. And that's not true. He's the measure of, according to this, he's the measure of all things wicked and sinful. But only those that find grace in the eyes of the Lord are righteous. I mean, it's because of his righteousness. All right, any other thoughts or questions? Lord willing, next week we'll get into Abraham's covenant. which is one of my favorites. Yeah.
I don't want to muddy up the waters, but I just wondered that they're the talk about the 120 years. If Noah begot three sons, those sons had to grow because he took sons with their wives into the ark.
Well, like he pointed out, though, he was 600 when the floodwaters came on, so they had 100 years to grow up.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I don't understand that time frame either. When did they become men? Did they become men at 15 and 16 years old? Like, you know, like the rest of us?
Most of them, it talks about having children somewhere between that 30 to 70 years.
Yeah, it was later on. Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe because that's when they got married. I don't know. It's an interesting time prior to the flood. Very interesting. The antediluvian fathers.
And all we know is what's in Genesis.
Yeah.
That's it. In Isaiah 65, it says, speaking of the future period, there shall be no more than some infinite days in the world.
Well, and Moses writes something about, you know, man's time be 70 years too. So, yeah. Sometimes when we try to get too literal about things, we fall into a ditch because there are other texts that are obviously not literal. But anyway, I plan on looking again at that 120 because we're getting, you know, I mean, you get more than one thing. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I don't think it changes the covenant structure. I don't think it changes redemption in any way. But it is interesting. It'd be interesting to know the chronological nature of that.
I think just 120 more years to flood makes more sense because if you like to say, if you look at the lives after that, if he meant they're going to just live 120 years,
It was close to 120, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't excessive.
I think Joseph made about 100. He didn't get all